Welcome to Scotland, figuratively speaking, if not actually in person.
Well, thank you so much. One of my the items on my bucket list is to someday visit Scotland. Unfortunately, I have not been able to do that yet, but I have glowing reports from everyone that's been there, so I'm
We
looking forward to it.
we'd love to have you, but do come in the summer, please, because we've still got snow here. I wanted to start by asking you a little bit about yourself and your upbringing. I do know that you're the son of Italian immigrants, at least one of them, and you were born in the
Yes,
Depression.
I was.
What was it like growing up in the Depression?
Well, I lived in an area that it would be characterized as Little Italy, which meant that most of the inhabitants in the area were of Italian descent. And it's an area called Federal Hill in Providence, Rhode Island. And the area in which I lived, I would suspect that 90% of the residents were either emigrated from Italy or were first-generation Americans. So everyone came from a working class family. My father was a fruit peddler, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom because in those days, mothers took care of their children and they stayed home and they nurtured their children and they cooked for their husbands and they did the wash and they did all of those things, and it was just a different world. But we were financially, we had very little material things in life. But today we would be characterized as very poor. But we didn't know we were poor because everyone was in the same boat, and things that people now consider to be a great hardship, we just took as part of ordinary everyday life. And that is that you got up early in the morning and that you went to work, and that if you were in school, that in many instances you had to work before you went to school and after you went to school, and there was always food on the table. So it was, in retrospect, when you think back, you say, oh my God, how did we survive under those conditions? Because today they would be considered substandard. But we thought they were normal because we came from a loving family. The basic unit of society is the family unit, and the family unit was strong. So while we lacked material things, we had extraordinary love and understanding and closeness in our family. And I think that is one of the sins of the world today, that the disintegration of the family unit is one of the sins of the world, in my judgment.
Was it a joyful upbringing?
No, I can't use the word joyful. It was I could use the word loving, because I think that many of the things that would have brought us great joy, we couldn't afford to do. It was always that was for the other people. We were happy and we had love. I mean, there were very few things. Now, we didn't travel and we didn't have fancy cars and we didn't have fancy clothes. Not that material things bring you joy, but in that sense, it wasn't joyful. It was a situation where people were economically depressed. And many times, we didn't have enough money at the end of the week to pay our bills. They ended up getting paid. No one ever defaulted on a payment.
Now, I know that you're from reading about you, your father put a lot of emphasis on education, encouraged you to get a good education.
My father was a pivotal factor in my life. He was actually my hero, and not because he was a great baseball player, or not because he was a great athlete, or not because he was a captain of industry, but because he got up at 4 o'clock every morning, whether he was sick or whether he wasn't feeling well, and he made no excuses, and he did that to support his family, and he made sure we had food on the table, and it was his encouragement. Without his encouragement, I would have just taken a job like everyone else, and I don't know, maybe driving a truck or doing something like that, which isn't all that bad, I suspect, but certainly would never have achieved the whatever successes I may have achieved in life. But he was my inspiration. He was the person that changed my life around in many, many ways, not only as a father, but as far as the direction of my life goes. Not only for me, but for my children as well.
And you had to put yourself through school to get that education.
I did, and I think back, and I don't know how I was able to do it physically. It was an endurance contest. I went to Providence College here in Providence. I was a day student. I couldn't afford to live in the dorms. And I worked in a restaurant washing dishes, and I worked at the local newspaper company putting papers together, and was able to earn enough money to get through school. But then reality hit me after I graduated from college. My lifelong dream was to attend law school. And I didn't have enough money. I had enough money for half a semester, and that was it. I taught school at a local high school in Providence, a high school called Hope High School. So I took the first year off. I didn't go to law school immediately. I could not attend. I had been accepted at Boston University. Boston University did not have a night law school, so I attended Suffolk University Law School in Boston. And we live in Providence. I was teaching in Providence. So I would teach during the day, then drive the 50 miles to Boston at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and attend night law school, and then drive back, go to teach the next day. And that was part of my routine. And I actually coached the wrestling team because I was able to get an extra $500 coaching the extra team, the wrestling team, and that helped me in addition to my salary. So that's how I went to law school. I taught in Providence, and I drove to law school nights in Boston.
Did those early experiences, I don't know if I want to use the word hardship, maybe that's the right word, but the hardships that you had growing up, does that give you more compassion now as a judge in court when maybe someone comes in there and they are down on their luck, or they're having trouble paying their bills and they owe maybe $500 or something for parking tickets?
Well, I just mentioned my dad a minute ago, and my dad would emphasize a couple of things. Number one, he would say, don't ever forget where you came from. And that encompasses a whole bunch of things. And he also said something else. I remember sitting by a potbelly stove with the oven door open because it was so cold in the winter that, you know, we didn't have enough heat in the house. And it was a pivotal moment in my life, I think. I was maybe 7 or 8, 10 years old. I'm not sure which. But at that point, my father gave me an edict from on high. He says, someday you're going to be a lawyer. And I never wanted to be anything else. He said to me back then, and I still remember it, he said, and when you become a lawyer, you can't charge poor people, but you make it up on the rich people. And he went on to say, because if we need a lawyer now, I couldn't afford one. He said, so you have to remember that. Don't ever, ever forget where you come from. So the teachings of my dad and his understanding and compassion and his humility, I remember very, very clearly, and I remember his words. So when I look at somebody, I don't look at an offense only. I do look at an offense, but I also look at an individual, and I look at a person, because so many times the hardship that people are enduring in their lifetime, in their personal lives, is the reason why they're before a court for something simple like, you know, traffic offenses. I take those, all of those, into consideration. You know, we many times talk about part of our role in life, you know, and I remember, even though my father didn't use these words, but basically what he would say to me was, you know, when you make it, think of the homeless, think of the poor, think of the downtrodden, think of the sick and the homeless, the hungry and the less fortunate. That's what he would preach, you know. He'd say, remember the underprivileged like we are, you know. So I remember those things, and I try to employ them in my deliberations on the court. I'm not dealing with machines. I'm dealing with human nature. I'm dealing with people who in our society today are enduring enormous hardship. And it's much tougher to be poor today than it was when I was a kid.
Really?
Because there's such a disparity now, because there's either the rich or the poor. And there are very few rich and an whole bunch of poor. And so I think it's much more difficult today than it was back then.
Does that consideration that you and your father have in that era, does that come from religion, or is it something else?
Well, I think religion plays a big part of it. Basically, you know, he was a very religious person, very strong religious convictions, God-fearing, as I am. So I think that's all part of our makeup, unquestionably.
Now, let me bring you forward in time. At some point, you set up your own legal practice. And what type of things did you get into with that legal practice?
Well, I must tell you, David, that when I first started practicing law, I was still teaching school. I had a night law practice, so I would leave school now, and I had my law degree, and I had a one-room office on one of the main streets in my neighborhood, not in the downtown business district, but in my neighborhood. I had a one-room law office, and I had office hours until the last person came in. And many times, no one came in. And as far as what type of cases we handled, David, back then, if anyone came in, whatever problem they had, I was an expert in that area. Because by the following day, I would know everything about that subject.
That's a little bit like radio interviewing.
Right. So you become an immediate expert. But we do a great deal of personal injury cases, and we handle the medical malpractice. And we have someone else that handles just domestic relations, and we have someone else that handles the state. So we spread out pretty well in our practice.
Let me ask you a kind of, I suppose it's a philosophical question. I don't know exactly what the right word is, but supposing someone comes into you and do you have the expression trying it on in the States?
Do I have a what?
Do you use the expression trying it on? In other words,
no.
What it means over here is basically they're like, maybe they're claiming for an injury or something like that that they don't really have, and they call it trying it on.
Oh yeah, I get that every day. I get that every day.
I know you get that in court. But supposing someone came to you as a lawyer, and you know as a client they're trying it on, how do you deal with that one?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, I call it playing the switchboard. Remember the old-fashioned switchboards where they would put a plug into these different holes until they connected?
Absolutely.
And so you call it trying it on. I have my saying, and it's called playing the switchboard. Well. If it's an attorney, obviously they're advocating for their client. But when people come in representing themselves, if they're honest with me, you know, then I usually take a different slant. But if they outright lie to me, then I have a whole different slant on that, you know. And I think our reputation here is that most people know, go in and see him and tell him the truth, you know, and you're going to get the best deal that you can. But if you try to come in with a fabricated story and pull the wool over my eyes, then I look at things a little bit differently. But sometimes even, you know, let's assume, David, just for purposes of this conversation, let's assume a woman comes in and she has like four kids and she's a single mom and she has three or four traffic cases and she's scared. And she comes in and she gives me a fabricated story, you know, in situations like that. So now I know she's giving me a fabricated story. So what do I do? So I say to her, okay, you know, you're lying to me. So what I'm going to do with you is I'm going to suspend your license because you can't pay these fines. And we're going to put a boot on your car and we're going to impound your car. Now, what I've done right there is I've punished all those kids because she has no money. Her car's going to be eventually, if her car gets impounded, it'll be towed and she won't be able to pay for the bill and they'll sell it. Plus, if she somehow or other is able to get some money from her budget, that means the kids may not eat that night. She can't drive them to school. So you try to balance the equities. So in that case, I think it's the human factor that comes in. And 99% of the time, I'll say to them, you know, why don't you just be honest with me and tell me what the real situation is? And then we try to negotiate it. We're dealing with human beings who have serious personal problems. You know, we're not dealing with machines, and there's no hard and fast rule. You know, and there's nothing wrong with exercising a modicum of compassion or understanding for people's personal lives. And I try to do that in the court.
You are Chief Municipal Court Judge in the city of Providence in Rhode Island. For people who don't know, over here, sort of Rhode Island would be sort of between New York and heading up towards Canada, somewhere that way. It's a fairly small state, if I'm not mistaken. And you deal with mainly, am I right in saying, mainly smaller issues like parking, traffic light violations, that type of thing, and one or two sort of civil disorders. Now, we're talking on Skype and we're not using video, but I cheated a little bit because I got a picture up on my screen of you. And the picture I've got is one where you're sitting there with a very young man on your lap with blonde hair. I think he's the one who gave his father a fine. I was wondering if you'd tell us that story.
Well, you know, the courtroom is a very intimidating experience for people. You have to just visualize a young man or a young girl coming into a courtroom their parents who have financial problems, you know, don't have great financial resources, coming into court, and they probably hear a conversation the day before that tomorrow, what is the judge going to do, you know? So they come in, and I always visualize, if I yell at a father or a mother in front of their child and give them a very harsh penalty and tell, you know, and berate them and say, what kind of an example are you setting for this young child? And really berate the parent and find them. When that kid leaves the courtroom, they will have an impression of the institutions of government that they're really not kind, that they have no consideration. They could leave hating the systems of government. You never know how that manifests itself later in life. So I try to set a favorable impression for young people particularly. And so I find that bringing them up on the bench, every time they leave, every kid that leaves, you know, leaves with a very good impression of the judicial system in our country, which they should. I think it serves a very worthwhile purpose. We've had some unbelievable responses from young people, you know. It's interesting. Most of the young kids that come up always say, "Give my parent a fine." For example, if it's $100 fine, they'll say, "Charge them 50 or charge them 60." And of course, I don't at that point. But kids are very honest. They're very sincere, and it's all toward having them have a favorable impression of the institutions of government, respect for authority, constituted authority.
It's no secret, certainly in the States and over here, that you've become a YouTube sensation. I know that came about because your brother started to film the court proceedings on a local community channel. But are you surprised how that skyrocketed and how much interest? I think someone told me, had over 1 billion hits on YouTube.
We have 1,300,000,000 hits.
That's a lot
on
of
YouTube.
Hits.
Yeah, that's worldwide. And I am surprised that just exercising basic decency and understanding and compassion has resounded so magnificently worldwide. I get letters from all over the world from people saying, you know, that they rarely see, and I'm surprised that they rarely see kindness and understanding and fairness like they see in my court. And I just can't believe it. It's flattering to me, but I just think it's a way of life that we should all employ.
You seem unfazed by the success of the whole thing.
I feel like it's someone else. I'm just doing what my dad taught me, which I've been doing my entire life. And all of a sudden, worldwide, people think it's like something unusual. And I am unfazed. You know,
I believe that one of the major networks is picking up the show, and you're going to be syndicated nationwide in the States?
We are going to be syndicated nationwide here in the United States. We'll be in every media market, and it will be syndicated beginning in September.
And I do know you're going with Fox, and I imagine eventually that will start to show over here, because Fox do have a channel in the UK as well. So I look forward to seeing that as well.
Well, if they show it in Scotland, then I'll just feel, Dave, to take a flight over to Scotland to view it. It'd be a good excuse for me to take a flight.
We'd love to have you here in person. It's literally only about 5 hours away from where you are, just a quick trip to the airport, 5 hours into Edinburgh. And I will personally, if you do come, pick you up at the airport. How's that for an offer?
That's a deal I can't refuse.
Listen, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. And we'll look out for you on Fox TV. And hopefully we'll see you one day in person here in the United Kingdom.
David, thank you so much for your kindness and for the opportunity to talk to the people of Scotland. I feel honored that you give me this opportunity. Thank you so much.